Hello, everyone, and welcome to DanaFem, where we engage you with stories of how innovators across the globe are using data to achieve new heights in their respective industries. I'm Danielle, founder of Dikayo Data, and I'm here with Reza Duploy of Data Lab Solutions. Reza is a fan of DanaFem, and we met on LinkedIn, so I'm really excited to have her here to answer some pretty burning questions I have about what it's like to manage a consulting business that's focused mainly on the data world that we all know and love. So sit back, relax as usual, and listen to what we have in store for you today. Yeah, let's get started. I'm so glad you're here. This has been a really fun work in progress from when we first connected on LinkedIn to now when we're actually recording. So it's great. I can't wait to hear what you have to say. And yeah, just tell me about Data Lab, why it started, what you do, how you fit in.
Of course. Data Lab is a small data analytics consultancy. We operate from Cape Town and London, and we offer professional services to clients globally. And most of the team works from South Africa, so typically we can offer quite a cost competitive consulting engagement for clients. But we focus on end-to-end cloud data analytics platform implementation for clients. Our people in the team are mostly skilled in things like data engineering and analytics engineering. And the services we offer our clients are around data strategy and BI roadmaps. We help clients choose and design the right cloud architecture. We do the data engineering, so integrating all of the data and transforming it. We help clients to visualize and exploit that data. We've also more recently started helping clients with embedded analytics and monetizing the data that they have. And we also help with capability and skills development within our clients' teams. The business was originally started in 2012, so this marks our 12-year anniversary, by Peter and Douglas, my two current business partners, who at that time was employed in a larger consultancy. So the drive for starting Data Lab at that time was really to deliver a better consulting experience to clients. They found that most consulting companies offered a bum in seat kind of model, and it really lacked the consulting aspect of things. And yeah, so Data Lab was born, hoping to be a more strategic advisor and partner to clients. My role in Data Lab has changed quite a lot. In 2015, I joined Peter and Douglas as an analytics engineer, just as they landed their second large project. And towards the end of 21, I joined the leadership team as a director and currently a co-owner of the business. My role has recently pivoted quite a bit to taking care of business growth, mostly focused on marketing and sales, client roadmaps, contracting, negotiations, and managing our relationships with various technology partners and helping to make sure our clients have a successful onboarding journey.
Coming on as an analytics engineer, I'm assuming you were kind of needed for seeing where the business needed to grow and analyzing that. But then now, you know, it's way more umbrella level And you might be less involved in the day-to-day analytics, but I'm sure that that technical knowledge still informs what you do day-to-day now.
Absolutely. So back when I really started getting involved in data and working on data warehouses, the two kind of cornerstone technologies was SQL Server and Power BI in its infant form, hidden back behind in Excel. So those were the two technologies that I worked with quite a lot. I used to do a lot of SQL querying and organization of the data, and then obviously pulling it into Power BI models, seeing how things start fitting together, where the data quality problems are, and figuring out what calculations are required to build the analytics that the clients need.
Yeah, and SQL is still super relevant. SQL is such a on the job language to learn because it's so hard to I guess simulate having a big database and learn by yourself when you don't have an actual company's database to work with. That's what made it hard for me to stay engaged with learning SQL because I had MySQL and it was connected to Tableau, not Power BI, but I definitely appreciate how Power BI and Excel work so well together. I guess I never had access to that large database that I needed to use, so I kind of fell off the wagon with learning it.
The one thing is actual data with actual problems in it. And I guess the other side of the coin is to work on the actual problem that you're trying to solve. So many of the courses you'll find, it will be very simplistic in terms of the examples and the exercises you need to work through, where a real database with real data and real client requirements is a very different scenario. So I guess theoretical knowledge will only get you so far, and the hands-on experiences then becomes invaluable.
I know nowadays certifications are kind of the big talk. Everybody wants to have them on LinkedIn. And there are a couple out there that are really good for AI and even business analytics. So I'm wondering if that's played a role for you. Did you get a bunch of certifications as an analytics engineer? Are there any that you would advise people to get now?
But I think certifications has played a role in my career development. I feel like I've never had the luxury of time to actually do a lot of them, but they do provide a structured learning path. They really help to validate your expertise and kind of keep you updated with the latest industry standards and technologies. They could also open up new opportunities for you. And as you say, if people share them on LinkedIn, they do build credibility. And they also obviously allow you to specialize in certain key areas of your work. They are not really, from my perspective, to be seen as the golden ticket. And often in the data industry, they need to be retaken, sometimes as often as annually, for them to remain relevant because these technologies are changing so rapidly. I guess I would advise people to focus on certifications around technologies that are widely recognized and relevant to the skills and tools most in demand in the industry. I guess there's nothing that can really beat solving real problems. And I think that's what I've enjoyed so much about being a consultant for, honestly, most of my career is it kind of feels like you're starting a new job every 6 or so months. Business analysis or data analysis, where you're trying to design a model that would support analytics, is for me a logical thinking process. And I'm not sure if you do know of a certification that can teach you that, I would love to introduce that to some of our team.
I'm definitely going to keep my ears open for that. Having that, I guess, bird's eye view on the industry, I do hear about a lot of certifications. It is really exciting that you get to work with all these companies, there's going to be so many different perspectives. You know, somebody's going to need help with implementing a new technology. Another person's going to need an organizational overhaul. And those, you know, those take, I guess, totally different approaches. What have you noticed? What are some challenges that all of your clients in this data industry are facing right now? What's a big overarching trend you've noticed? And how have you been addressing these challenges in particular?
Many of our clients face quite a big and critical skills gap and a shortage of talent in this field of data analytics. There seems to be a growing demand for skilled data professionals, but the supply is really limited. And we see this in our business in the recruitment process. I guess it kind of correlates with the massive growth of data. But yeah, many clients struggle with this, and they obviously then struggle to leverage advanced analytics tools effectively due to this lack of in-house expertise. And this situation kind of often leads them to seek external consultancies, which can obviously become quite expensive. These businesses would then often struggle, and this is also a challenge we see in most of our clients, is to quantify the return on investment for their data initiatives and to justify these ongoing expenses. I guess to try and address these challenges, we would often encourage our clients to focus on delivering tangible business value by trying to properly align data initiatives with strategic goals. So our approach would usually involve designing use cases that drive measurable outcomes, such as increasing efficiency somehow, or reducing costs, or driving revenue. So to help make sure that this investment in building a data analytics capability can actually yield significant returns. One of the key movements we've observed and positioned in South Africa, it works out quite well for us, is the like offshoring or outsourcing of your data analytics consulting capabilities. In South Africa, and especially Cape Town, we've got a great pool of highly skilled data professionals. With kind of a lower cost of living and labor rates, we can obviously provide a top-tier talent at more affordable rates. So I think that's kind of how we try and help our clients with solving the challenge of the perception that data analytics problems are really expensive and that they do require quite specialized expertise skills.
Are you normally pointing them towards ways of finding that talent, you know, like looking to put that talent in-house long-term, or do you improve efficiency by like giving them sustainable ways to teach who they already have?
Yeah, I think the one approach that we have in these kind of scenarios where Datalab would come in and help lay the foundation. So set in the benchmark of how this data architecture would work, how we deliver on certain things. In doing that, we typically would want one or two of the key client resources internally to take on the journey with us, to make sure that it is something sustainable that they can run with, minor tweaks and changes they can handle. And typically then our clients would come back to us when there's another larger piece of work or a design requirement, where we jump in and assist. So they've kind of got this flexibility to scale their team up and down based on project requirements. And this kind of makes sure that they have the right resources in place when needed, allowing them to adapt quickly to changing demands and keeping the cost of resourcing lower on their side, because this might not be a necessary skill or expertise for them to have full time.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of that companies kind of hearing the buzzwords and feeling pressure to bring on a certain level of investment or a certain technology setup that they might not need. What are some ways you convince them if they're invested in things that you think that they don't need, but they might be attached to?
We mostly try and convince our clients to not be attached to Excel, to be honest, and don't hire a data scientist before looking after your data quality and completeness.
I agree with all of the new BI tools coming out and updating all the time that Excel can leave a lot to be desired in terms of efficiency. But then at the same time, you mentioned Power BI, and Power BI, from my understanding, is pretty much integrated into Excel using Excel as its home environment. So I think there is some relevance still if you can integrate Excel into a larger strategy, perhaps.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the beauty of designing a data architecture well, where you can still have your data set in a governed model, where the calculations are protected, user access is controlled, and still allow the users to access that through an interface like Excel. And the data will refresh, and if calculations are changed or updated, that will trickle through to the spreadsheets that they have for analysis or self-service exploration. But the data will still be governed and controlled and secured. So I'm not dissing Excel. I use it every day. It's just how you use it and for what.
Do you feel like people are generally educated on ways to automate, or do they come to you with a very not new perspective, but like kind of a blank slate?
We find most of our clients in quite an immature state of data, where they might have some kind of operational reporting going on, but they really haven't gone and consolidated all their data into some kind of data warehouse. Typically, we would find our clients at a stage where none of these processes are automated. And our typical journey with a client starts at describing the purpose and different functionalities of a data platform, describing technologies and how certain technologies are better for certain use cases, and taking them on that journey, to understand what it is that they need to do.
With Datalab, you can unlock the power of unified data. Collaboration fuels innovation, and the same goes for your data. Many organizations face challenges with diverse data ecosystems, legacy systems, and data silos. Datalab can bring your data together into a single source of truth, enhancing analytics, data science, Gen AI, and self-service capabilities. Plus, you can cut your consulting costs by 30% by offshoring your projects to top talent in South Africa. Are you ready to transform your data strategy? Visit www.datalabsolutions.co.uk. This will also be in the show notes. Now back to our show. I know you and I have talked about the pressure to stay relevant. How much do you feel like you have to be a data practitioner yourself to be able to communicate with these clients, even about partnerships?
I think as the data analytics professionals in our team obviously have day-to-day technical experience. And I think for me to try and stay relevant in current technology is absolutely essential. I guess this is one of my biggest challenges because I don't actually get to work with the nitty-gritty of the problem every single day. And so with new tools, techniques, methodologies, like constantly emerging, it's really quite difficult to keep up. A good solution architecture today might look quite clunky in 2 months from now, with the rate things are moving, especially in the AI space. For me to try and stay updated, at least with the trends and new solutions, I regularly attend webinars and listen to podcasts. So weekly, I would listen to at least one or two webinars or podcasts where new topics, technologies, or research is unpacked. As technology partners, we also obviously get access to a lot of resources around the technologies that we use. I also like to attend a good old user group where you get the opportunity to network with people, connect with people in the field, and hear about the work that they're doing. And then if time allows, I love to attend talks and conferences. Conferences typically slams you with a lot of new ideas and information, and I usually feel quite inspired after attending a conference. And typically, all of these ideas, the use cases that like I've barely scratched the surface on, would trickle through to our team. And I guess this is where I try to get the hands-on experience. So mostly they would be executing on the ideas for clients, and we'll have a bit of Q&A on what they're doing and how they can potentially improve the design. I am becoming very rusty on the coding side, but I think I also need to accept that.
You mentioned conferences. I love conferences myself. Are you going more from a networking perspective to talk to potential clients who are also there learning the technologies, or are you going more as a student, like learning, I guess, the student of what's out there and, looking at the sponsoring companies and what they have to offer? Or do you have to do a combination?
It's a bit of a combination, but the focus would be more on being a student for the day or two. I think you leave with a lot more if you really lean into the talks and let your imagination flow on how you could go and apply these things at the different clients that we have. It's always great when you meet a new client at a conference, but to be honest, that has rarely ever happened.
I've been wondering why that is, because I've also noticed the same thing, and I think your advice is really valuable because, it seems like there's a conference every day that people are flying out to, and it can be a lot of pressure to, I guess, feel like you have to run around all the booths and make the circles and, convince everybody why what you're selling is the best. I've never really sealed a deal at a conference the way that I'm capable of doing that online, if that makes sense.
No, I think you'll probably have better luck sealing a deal at some kind of a after hour happy hour event.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And those happy hour events are really fun, but I feel like most of the time people just want to talk about what they learned and are less into the business deals of things. It seems that way sometimes.
For us as a leadership team, we all come from technical backgrounds. None of us are salespeople. So typically, we also enjoy those conversations, just talking about what you've learned for the day and, what are you doing that's interesting in your business?
Of course, I actually was attending Posit, former R Studio at the Times annual conference in San Francisco in January 2020 when big news about COVID-19 broke out. Just a few months later, we were on lockdown. It took really 2 even longer years for live events to come back and be like we remember them. And in the meantime, there was a lot of virtual events that were focused around the type of networking we described with the happy hours at conferences. And I know you had mentioned how you study using podcasts and webinars virtually. So I'm curious about your take on how virtual events, even before the pandemic, but especially during and after, compare to conferences, the live, big, booming, exciting conferences that we were discussing in terms of networking and learning opportunities specifically.
Yeah, I think being involved in delivering both virtual and live events, I've observed advantages and challenges with each format. I think both obviously aims to educate, engage, and inspire audiences, but making them successful can vary quite significantly. I think virtual events offers a broader reach, which is amazing for us sitting at the bottom of the planet in South Africa. They're obviously quite cost effective, and it allows us to collect more data on the attendees. The biggest challenge is the limited interaction with the audience. So keeping the participants engaged can be challenging. And I know this from watching webinars. I often drift, even if it is really interesting, the topic. There's obviously potential distractions, and the lack of that face-to-face interaction can be quite difficult. Personal events allows you to form that personal connection with the audience. The energy, the atmosphere, like you mentioned, at a conference of a live event can really enhance the overall experience, making it more memorable, people focus more. But I guess organizing these live events, and we do monthly, more or less, host user groups, it does involve a bit of logistics in venue booking and all kinds of arrangements. So they typically like incur a bit of a higher cost related to travel and all those things. And you don't always have the time or appetite for that. So it's really convenient to just join a webinar from your desk at home. So I do think they both have pros and cons.
I'd agree with that. I think, you know, sometimes with an online webinar, I'm not engaged in the same way, but I might pick up this one little bit of information that's all I need. And then I go really far with that. Whereas with the conference, there's so much coming at me that I might write down a million little nuggets of wisdom, but the chance of me coming back to any of them and really being able to like continue down that pipeline, I don't know, you know? So it's definitely great that there are so many ways to take in knowledge, and that, you know, you're doing so many of them as part of your work all the time. What's some big lessons you've learned from working with clients of different sizes, and like how has that shaped your approach growing?
They all start at different levels of data maturity and different end goals, and we might be consulting into the business as an enterprise, and sometimes when it's in a really large company, it would be just a department. Change management and the importance of like early user adoption is often overlooked everywhere. And then embarking on a data initiative will create very limited long-term change, and even worse, limited value, if the use of that data does not become part of the day-to-day in how the business operates. So our approach would typically include engaging stakeholders early. I mentioned providing continuous training and fostering that data-driven culture with the client. You mentioned earlier low-code or no-code tools. These are great because the tools are becoming more user-friendly and accessible, and that also encourages a more widespread adoption across the organization, kind of breaking down that technical barrier of working with things.
Yeah, I find that a lot of the low-code, no-code solutions still require a user to think like a data scientist and kind of pick up that data literacy, even if you're not deep in the code. I wouldn't trade my coding background for anything, and I still hope to learn more, but I feel like you can learn a lot from these solutions that I guess mirror how all of our brains take in and think about data. And I think that's why knowledge graphs are so powerful now too, because they can really mirror how our brain would be processing this data anyway. So we're not fighting our brains to learn something counterintuitive, or just more looking at a visual tool that helps us understand, you know, what's naturally going on.
I think that's where the differentiation comes in between, again, what do you need in terms of expertise to get to a certain point, and how do you then continue to work with that data or that technology on an ongoing basis in your organization? I often use the example of a NetSuite implementation. Like, a client deciding to start running their business on NetSuite won't have the capacity or the expertise to like successfully configure and implement this working software, but nor do they need those skills long term. Like, once the software is up and running, the team will be working with it, they'll start learning it, they will find their ways of engaging with the system, and they can run with it. So I do think there's a role for implementation partners and big bang approach to expertise and implementation, and then teams being able to work with technologies that's been implemented well on a day-to-day basis.
I know that you've been working in the tech industry for a while now. How, I guess, have you seen it change in the time that you've been working, and what do you think makes consulting in tech different from consulting in other fields?
Sure. I think over the past 15 odd years, the data industry and the tech industry at large have undergone profound transformations. I've witnessed these changes obviously firsthand, and they've reshaped how businesses operate and make decisions. In data specifically, we've seen an explosion in the growth of data driven by the sheer amount of digital devices, the IoT devices, social media, online transactions. And we've also seen the rise of cloud computing, making data storage and processing like very scalable and cost effective, completely eliminating that need for heavy on-premise infrastructure. So data analytics has also shifted, and you as a data scientist would know that companies have gone from focusing on merely describing historical data now to the need to predict future trends and prescribe actions for optimized outcomes. The whole rise of self-service BI and low-code tools has been breaking down these technical barriers. Consulting definitely differs in data versus something like management consulting, driven by this unique, rapid change of technology all the time. I think one of our biggest opportunities is also a threat, which is this pace of change that we need to deal with. So our consultants must obviously stay current with the latest advancements, continually improving. We need to prioritize innovation and experimentation. So we often allow our team quite a lot of time. And as a consulting company, that is quite an expensive thing to do, but making sure they have time to experiment, innovate, do certifications, learn, because these guys need deep technical expertise to be able to deliver the right quality service to clients.
A lot of my listeners are binging this podcast to learn about the companies that they might want to work for. A lot of my sponsoring companies are on here to talk about hiring opportunities and their organization's culture. I guess I'm wondering, like, do you think it's easy to move between consulting and working at one of these companies? Like, what have you noticed about the transition, both from somebody who's working as a data scientist thinking like, okay, now I want to be in consulting, or the other way around? Like, do you think there's a pretty easy transition there, or would it be difficult?
What we've seen, especially when we've hired new recruits from larger companies where typically they've been working in a department context and the subject matter is the same, the pace that is expected of them isn't always that rapid. They experience a bit of overwhelm when they go into consulting. The senior people usually has to deal with quite a bit of context switching. So they might be supporting more than one client at a time. So you could be talking about how we're going to track weather metrics on an orchard, and later in the day, discuss how we are going to report on the assets under management metric. So I think there might be a bit of overwhelm for the consultants. We've partnered with a talent assessment company, and this is to make sure we hire like top tier people, but it's also to try and determine whether their personality has the right fit for consulting. Not all people are inclined to enjoy that kind of environment where things move really quickly, expectations are constantly high. And people who enjoy that, we've seen, typically experiences a bit of boredom when they are going to a company where they work in a team, the roadmap is set, the pace of change isn't that fast. We haven't seen an employee go to work for a company like ThoughtSpot or Snowflake, so we wouldn't know what their experience was with that transition. I must say, I think that would probably be quite exciting.
Especially from the episode I did with ThoughtSpot, talking about the pace and the goals of innovating with Gen AI, it just seems like there's this fast track to success that they keep achieving. And that is really exciting to see, and I'm sure even more exciting to be a part of. What it seems would most unite any job or business opportunity, from what we've been talking about and just from knowledge of being in the business world, is communicating and contributing value. Something that you've brought up before is that people are coming to you with these projects that seem to under deliver on the expected value, and that's kind of where, you know, your clients are worried about losing this value with their own partners and, you know, obviously profits and monetary value. So what are the main factors that people starting a new project need to consider, whether it's digital transformation or a data project? What are the best ways to set up for success even before you take any first step?
There's a few things to consider, but I think every successful digital transformation project really starts with a clear and integrated strategy that outlines the why, the what, and the how of this transformation process. And the strategy should obviously be tied to specific quantified business outcomes. We also, when we engage in projects, require leadership commitment, but not just from the top level, but all the way through to middle management. The high-level commitment ensures that the transformation has the necessary support and resources. And therefore, the middle management is often overlooked, but their ownership and accountability are so vital because they're the ones driving the day-to-day implementation and overcoming this resistance to change. We also always encourage like an agile governance approach, addressing roadblocks quickly and adapting to changing context. This mindset is quite mission-oriented, with like having a fail fast, learn kind of attitude throughout the organization really helps. Establishing clear metrics and targets around processes and outcomes are also critical for tracking progress of the initiative. And then obviously regular monitoring helps make sure that you can make the necessary adjustments and stay on track towards a certain defined outcome. And then I guess finally, people often think they can do this without technology, but you need to implement fit for purpose modern technologies, but driven by business needs. So they enable you to securely and scalably implement your transformation solutions.
What are some projects or types of projects that are upcoming that you're excited to work on?
Oh, my business partner and I just made an action list about an hour ago. So for two of our clients, we're talking about large language model solutions to do sentiment analysis on call centers, which is very exciting for us. We are potentially looking at supporting a fresh produce producer in South Africa, which is a really, it's just such a fundamentally good business. Not necessarily in terms of the margin or the processes, it's highly complex, but just to think we can try and help someone that is producing fresh fruits into the industry is just really great. The one other opportunity that really excites us is an engagement with a legal advisory firm. In that scenario, Snowflake offers quite extensive document AI functionalities, and we can see some really interesting use cases there for that.
Well, congratulations. If those two projects are any indicator of the variety that you get to experience on a regular basis, then I see how exciting the consulting field and especially data labs in the consulting field can be to be able to invest in a local business that means a lot to you and your surroundings in South Africa, but then at the same time also expand into this new legal knowledge and that side of the business that not many people know about. I find that so exciting. And as we wrap up our multifaceted discussion, I want to get your take on what the future holds for LLMs and what you expect to happen.
Yeah, I think we see LLMs as quite a significant force propelling the adoption of Gen AI across industries. We see this because it's lowering the barrier to entry. So they offer these pre-trained foundation for Gen AI applications. So it reduces a lot of the complexity and costs associated with developing custom models from scratch, making it much more accessible to a wider range of businesses. They've got impressive capabilities in tasks like text generation and image creation. I think they're really driving innovation in the AI techniques, constantly pushing the boundaries. I think with the arrival of ChatGPT, that's kind of marked a significant like step in this journey to AI. So we're very excited about it. We're obviously deeply in the learning phase as we try and properly understand the use cases, the differences in models, how you choose the right model, how you're going to implement this technical architecture. So for us, it's a massive learning journey, but it's also an exciting one.
The most exciting part to me is honestly how accessible the technology and its benefits are to people who might not yet be data literate. But they can still learn about chatbot technology and dip their toes into AI and its implications by using ChatGPT or whatever chatbot they come across for daily things. I have a few tarot card decks that don't come with explanations. And so if I'm using one of those decks to do a reading for somebody, I'll often use ChatGPT as my resource for interpreting the meaning of a card. And it's always nice to be able to have that discussion back and forth using specific circumstances in my or the person I'm reading for's life and grapple with the situation along with ChatGPT as if it were a sentient being, even though I know that it's not. Basically, a lot of the cutting edge inventions in AI and data science have felt very erudite and removed from what the general public understands and needs. So, if data literacy is the goal, I think there really could be something to tap into with these LLMs.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's a whole new skill set for us to learn now. If we think about things like Snowflake has a copilot in it where you can ask it in natural language to write a SQL query for you, it can make us so efficient and I guess more creative because you don't have to fiddle around with the code to make sure it works. You can do more in less time. So I think this new skill set is very interesting, deepening our knowledge of LLMs, how they work, their strengths, their limitations, learning how to properly write prompts that are clear and concise, specific to the task at hand, and really getting comfortable with experimenting with different phrasing and structures.
I think just feeling heard too, in a way, like when I'm Googling something, if it doesn't give me the search results that I'm looking for, I kind of sigh and then just try something else. But when it's a chatbot that I'm talking to, I can say, well, that wasn't exactly what I thought. Can you think about it like this? You know, it just feels more like a dialogue and a communication, which makes me feel at least more confident that I'm gonna get to an answer that works for what I need at the end.
Yes, absolutely. And I guess the more data that is fed to them and the more instruction given to them, like the more accurate they become. I've started playing around with custom GPTs and I've got a lot to learn still around that. But just like saving that knowledge, and my business partner has also done a presentation on RAG, where you supply additional information to the large language model in document forms or whatever to make sure that the responses are more accurate. So I think the use cases are very interesting in how organizations actually implement these things because it's obviously been trained on a lot of publicly available data, and to make them useful in an enterprise, you would need to couple that with enterprise-specific data.
Well, look at that. Look how much we covered. You answered all of my questions and several more that I didn't even know I had, which is the sign of a great, great interview and episode.
Yeah, this has been great. I really enjoyed chatting to you. I would love to have done this over a coffee.
Exactly. I know. I would love that too. I would love to, like, coffee or like a wine bar in South Africa. Like, I'm definitely wanting to come visit. And for those of you already in the South Africa area, I'm sure you can tell and you know that Reza would be a great contact to have and a resource to reach out to. I will be including Reza's LinkedIn profile, a link to that, as well as the link that I mentioned in the mid-roll ad to Data Lab's site so that you can stay updated on the exciting projects that we all just heard about in this episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. You know you can find me always on LinkedIn through Dikayo Data or Danielle LeBlanc, and I look forward to catching you next episode.
You'll never.